This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 3rd, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, a top UN official calls on the U.S. to end its CIA drone program, saying the targeting killings violate international accountability. Immigration activists protest in the Capitol as Arizona's governor meets with President Obama. And as the Gulf region struggles with the BP oil spill, we'll look at how the disaster is affecting other parts of the economy. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israel today rejected a call from the United Nations for an international investigation into the Israeli raid on a Gaza-bound aid ship. 9 activists were killed in fighting after armed Israeli commandos boarded the ship, which was part of a larger flotilla bringing humanitarian aid to the occupied territory. UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon says Israel must provide a full and detailed account of the incident.
Everything must be done to prevent another incident of this kind. All concerned should act with a sense of care and responsibility and in accordance with international law. At this sensitive time, it is essential to avoid provocations.
Israel has said it will conduct an internal investigation, but it has not confirmed it will allow international observers to oversee that process. Today, thousands of mourners in Turkey attended the funerals of several of the dead activists. The Anatolia News Agency has identified one of the dead as 19-year-old U.S. citizen Furkan Dogan. He was found with 4 bullet wounds in the head and 1 in the chest. The Turkish charity that helped organize the flotilla says at least 3 activists are still missing. Israel has had very few people come to its defense on the matter, but last night, Vice President Joe Biden told Charlie Rose Israel was within its rights.
I think Israel has an absolute right to deal with its security interest. I put all this back on 2 things. 1, Hamas. And 2, Israel's need to be more generous relative to the Palestinian people who are in trouble in Gaza.
Today, U.S. Envoy George Mitchell said the U.S. would continue to work to meet the full range of needs of the people of Gaza. Activists and human rights observers in Mexico are preparing a second aid caravan to an indigenous village in Oaxaca that has been blockaded by paramilitaries since November. FSRN's Shannon Young has more.
The call for the second aid caravan to the town of San Juan Copala came just days after paramilitaries opened fire on a convoy of human rights defenders, teachers, activists, international observers, and reporters. The April 27th ambush killed a prominent Mexican activist and a Finnish observer. The second aid caravan to San Juan Copala is due to leave Mexico City on Monday evening. Organizers say 350 people have signed up to participate and deliver 13 tons of donated aid. The paramilitary group accused of perpetrating the April attack has been linked to the PRI, the party that has ruled Oaxaca without interruption for the past 80 years. Survivors of the first caravan say no police investigators have contacted them for their eyewitness accounts of the ambush. Members of the European Parliament have called on the government of Mexico to guarantee the safety of next week's caravan. A leading congressman who is planning to participate says requests for security guarantees made to the Oaxaca state government have gone unanswered. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
The California State Assembly has passed legislation that bans the use of plastic bags at retail establishments such as grocery and convenience stores. The single-use plastic bag ban also includes a ban on free paper bags, but allows stores to sell bags with at least a 40% recycled paper content. No Republicans supported the bill, which now will go to the state Senate for approval. It has the support of the governor, and if passed, California would become the first state in the U.S. to enact such a ban. The plastics industry opposes the bill, saying it will cost jobs, but supporters say the environmental impact of single-use plastic bags is millions of dollars per year. This Saturday, the UN will observe the World Environment Day to call attention to environmental issues and push for political action. Coinciding with this year's observance, the UN Environment Program has released a new report on the positive economic impacts of conservation. As FSRN's Mohamed Youssef reports, UN officials presented the report today in Kenya.
According to the new UN report entitled Dead Planet and Living Planet, restoring lost and damaged ecosystems like forests and wetlands can trigger multi-million dollars returns, generate jobs, and combat poverty. UNEP Deputy Director Tim Kasten told reporters in Nairobi that even though communities reap many intangible benefits from a healthy ecosystem, it is necessary to speak the economic language of policymakers.
Altogether, these services are providing up to $70 trillion per year. It is, in fact, a very significant contribution.
60% of the world's ecosystem already degraded, and now restoration and management of intact ecosystem must be the key priority, according to the report. The UN says governments must begin seeing environmental conservation as an economic benefit rather than a hindrance to development. Mohamed Yusuf, FSRN, Nairobi.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Today, a senior UN official called on the U.S. to stop the CIA drone attacks in Pakistan, saying that the program lacked transparency and accountability. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, Philip Alston, presented the report to the UN Human Rights Council today in Geneva. Alston said the U.S. defense of its CIA drone program was expansive and open-ended and comes close to destroying rules of the UN Charter.
Hundreds of people have been killed as a result, including some innocent civilians. Because this program remains shrouded in official secrecy, the international community does not know when and where the CIA is authorized to kill, the criteria for individuals who may be killed, how it ensures killings are legal, and what follow-up there is when civilians are illegally killed. In a situation in which there is no disclosure of who has been killed, for what reason, and whether innocent civilians have died, the legal principle of international accountability is, by definition, comprehensively violated.
Alston did acknowledge targeted killings could be legal when used against combatants and in accordance with international rules, but also warned that the spread of killings based on current U.S. policy could encourage other states and lead to chaos. This report comes as the Obama administration has vastly expanded unmanned drone attacks, and many are raising concern over secrecy and the number of civilians killed. Others, including the ACLU and legal scholars, have also challenged the legality of the drone program. To learn more, we're joined by Mary Ellen O'Connell, law professor at Notre Dame and an expert in international law and armed conflict. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
The UN report goes into the background of targeted killings, which have been used by various countries, not just the U.S., but also Russia in Chechnya, Israel in occupied territories, and that the term, unlike assassination or summary execution, is not identified under international law. What is the current law with regards to targeted killings?
Well, as the report makes clear, we really need to talk about targeted killing in two different contexts. During an armed conflict, during hostilities, lawful combatants, members of, for example, the United States Armed Forces, certainly would have the right to target and kill persons who are on the battlefield with them and posing a lethal threat. They could certainly use drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, or planes to carry out those killings. And so if you call those targeted killings, which they definitely could be under the definition provided in the report, they would generally be lawful. The problem that the report really pinpoints in terms of legality is when drones and other methods for killing are used far away from a battlefield. And then killing really needs to follow the rules that we apply to our law enforcement agents.
Well, speaking of the legal framework around this, U.S. State Department legal advisor Harold Coe defended the U.S. drone program recently, saying that it is legal under a right of self-defense. The argument goes that the U.S. is actively fighting Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and, quote, associates, so lethal strikes are within the U.S. rights. The report says that this argument lacks support under international law. How so?
Yes, I agree with the report's conclusion on this matter. if a country is attacked by another country or agents of that other country, it's certainly lawful to respond in self-defense, using force that's necessary and proportional to respond to the attack. But the kinds of attacks that we believe these members of Al-Qaeda scattered around the world or their associates in the Taliban are carrying out are on the scale of criminal activities, of terrorist-type attacks, and they are much lower level, not arising to the level that we're allowed to use force in self-defense. The UN Special Rapporteur is pointing to that to carry out lethal force against an individual somewhere in downtown Sana'a, Yemen, as if he were a country attacking the United States of the scale that we saw with Afghanistan supporting Al-Qaeda's attack on us on 9/11, is simply exaggerating what the real facts are. And international law simply doesn't allow military-type, combat-type force against a low-level criminal who's carrying out that sort of attack, planning that sort of attack on the United States.
Well, the report looks at targeted killings, but it focuses a lot of attention, of course, on drone technology and the use of drones in those killings. It says that 40 countries now have drone technology. It warns of the possibility that non-state groups could get their hands on this technology. If this is the future of warfare, what legal protections should be put in place in order to oversee these kinds of killings?
I think we're fairly confident that some non-state actor groups already do have drones. And so the report is very timely. It's important to think about every new technology in terms of the law of armed conflict when it comes about. The scenario is really not different. Periodically, our scientists invent new ways for us to kill each other, and international humanitarian law, the law of armed conflict, really is does have the means to continue to adapt to take into account new challenges. This is the newest challenge.
Mary Ellen O'Connell is a law professor at Notre Dame and an expert in international law and armed conflict. She joined us to talk about a report on targeting killings and the U.S. drone program presented to the U.N. Human Rights Council today in Geneva. Thank you for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome.
Family members and supporters of an American lawyer arrested in Rwanda are urging his release. Rwandan authorities detained Peter Erlinder in Kigali last Friday. The William Mitchell College of Law professor was in the country to represent Victoria Ingabire, the leader of the United Democratic Forces, who was arrested on charges of promoting genocide ideology last month. In audio posted to the BBC today, Erlinda's daughter disputed claims by Rwandan officials that he tried to commit suicide.
We, as his family and friends and everyone who knows him, don't believe that he would try to take his life. And it's really caused us even more alarm because we're now, concerned that this is really laying the groundwork for something else to happen to him and for it to be blamed on suicide.
The family is also trying to meet with State Department officials who could help bargain for his release. At a briefing Wednesday, Assistant Secretary Philip Crowley had only limited information on his condition and status.
All I can tell you is that we have visited and spoken with Peter Erlinder. He was taken to the hospital this morning and remained there overnight for observation. His U.S. and Rwandan attorneys have had access to him, and we expect that due process will be accorded by the Rwandans in a timely and transparent way.
So far, the Obama administration has not publicly called for his release. Erlinder represented defendants in Rwandan genocide war crime trials and heads the Association of Defense Lawyers for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He also helped file a lawsuit against Paul Kagame this year, charging the Rwandan president with ordering the political assassinations that triggered the Rwandan genocide. Presidential elections in Rwanda take place in August, and many are voicing concerns about a crackdown on opposition candidates and freedom of speech. Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, sent a letter to President Obama asking him to reverse his temporary ban on deepwater offshore oil drilling. Jindal says the ban could cost the state tens of thousands of jobs. As the Gulf Coast economy continues to suffer, FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports on the oil spill's impact on the rest of the American economy.
Pictures of empty tourist beach destinations in Louisiana and docked shrimp boats are a constant reminder of the decimated livelihood of the Gulf Coast. But something called the disaster economy is kicking into gear. Charles Colgan is a professor at the University of Southern Maine.
It'll be a short-term boom for things like some of the lost tourists in the coastal areas may be made up by oil spill workers, for example, in some of the hotels.
Colgan says the economy will see a slight reshuffling.
From a national point of view, people aren't going to stop taking vacations because of the oil spill. They'll go somewhere else. And so the local economies will be affected, even if the national economy isn't.
The average American not relying on the Gulf for livelihood is not yet feeling the impact. And economists say it's too early to tell if they will. Chris Driscoll is an energy analyst at Tradition Energy.
Sort of a wait and see if they can actually stop this, contain it enough where it really doesn't cause havoc. But, you know, like I said, if it really just keeps on going, it could in the long term hurt long-term oil prices and gas prices.
The daily spills 10 to 12,000 barrels is a drop in the bucket of the 85 million barrels produced around the world in a day. But Steve Kopitz, energy analyst at Douglas Westwood, estimates that if the oil rigs are idle for another 6 months, it could cost the oil and gas industry $5 billion. He says the oil companies would reap half the loss. But he admits, for a wealthy industry, it's pocket change.
The impact on the large oil companies should be fairly small. You know, if you take five or six big companies and spread $5 billion amongst them, that's not a huge amount of loss for any of the big companies.
He says the more painful economic impact would be felt by the companies that work in the oil industry, the supply vessels, parts and service suppliers, catering companies, and more. In a letter to the president, Louisiana Governor Jindal points to job loss as a reason to rethink the deep water drilling ban. That's where economics meets politics. Easy-to-drill oil is running dry, and energy analysts say the U.S. could deplete its 5 million barrel of oil reserves in a couple of years, which could mean more importation from the Middle East and possibly political pressure to open places like Anwar. This has caused President Obama to renew his focus on green energy. He spoke Wednesday at Carnegie Mellon University.
The time has come to aggressively accelerate that transition. The time has come once and for all for this nation to fully embrace a clean energy future.
The market could help dictate deep water drilling's future. Economists say the risks associated with deep water drilling could cause investors to second-guess financing. And to add to the increased costs, Moody's released a report Thursday that said insurance premiums for oil rigs have already increased 15 to 25%. The direct cleanup costs are about to surpass the $1 billion mark, and environmental costs are another component that's taken into consideration. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
President Obama is hearing the same message on immigration from different sides of the debate, that the federal government needs to fix the immigration system. That's the message Arizona Governor Jan Brewer brought to her face-to-face meeting with the president Thursday. And that's also what a group of immigrant rights activists outside the White House said as they protested Brewer's visit. Tanya Snyder reports.
Ruben says he has lived for too long under the shadow of fear.
I came here when I was four. I do not know where I come from. I just know it by name. My country is the United States. The only thing that is holding me back is papers. Papers that are called green card. Papers that is called residency. I need it, Mr. President. I need it now.
Hundreds like Ruben and their advocates gathered at the White House Thursday as President Obama spoke with Arizona Governor Jan Brewer. Organizers say they understand the frustration of those who support Arizona's new immigration law as a way to try to fix a system left broken by federal inaction.
We share that frustration. But SB 1070 is a wrong solution to a serious problem.
Governor Brewer recently defended the new law on CNN, saying the president was wrong to call it misguided and misdirected.
If you're living in Arizona and you're living in the areas that are severely impacted, you are faced with it on a daily basis. And we're not going to put up with it anymore. We have borders. Every nation has reasons to have lines, borders, might you say, you know? And a nation without borders is like a house without walls. It collapses. And that's what's going to happen to America.
The Justice Department is looking into the constitutionality of Arizona's law, which requires police officers to question anyone whom they suspect of being in the country illegally. If the law is found to be in violation, the federal government could block its implementation next month. And that's not the only legal challenge in the works. The city of Tucson, Arizona, has joined a civil suit against the new law. The suit was brought by Tucson police officer Martin Escobar, who initially named Tucson as one of the defendants. Now the city is a plaintiff, pressing for the law to be repealed. The immigrant rights movement has been upping the ante ever since Arizona passed its law in April. Dozens have been arrested all over the country in protest of the law and pushing for comprehensive reform. A few weeks ago, five immigrants held a sit-in in Senator John McCain's Tucson office. Three of them are undocumented and may face deportation. And in New York, 18 undocumented immigrants and their allies are currently holding a hunger strike outside the office of Senator Chuck Schumer, who's promised to push passage of the DREAM Act. But protesters are frustrated with the slow pace. The DREAM Act creates a path to citizenship for young people who are brought to the country illegally as minors if they go to college or join the military. Jose Luis Zacatelco is one of the hunger strikers.
The DREAM Act came about in 2001, so when it came out, I was really happy because I thought that while I was doing my education, I would become a citizen and or a resident and then eventually a citizen. But it's been 10 years. It's been 10 years that the DREAM Act has been sitting around moving from committee to committee.
In the time that the DREAM Act has been discussed and debated in Congress, Zacatelco slipped out of its reach. The DREAM Act only applies to people who immigrated before they were 16 and who are now under 30. Zacatelco turned 30 last month. Still, he continues to fight for its passage.
I know what it is to be undocumented.
He says he'll stay on the hunger strike for weeks if necessary to force Congress to act. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
In Berkeley, California tonight, local officials will discuss a controversial new plan that could threaten affordable housing. Across the U.S., publicly owned affordable housing is getting harder to come by. The programs are often expensive to operate and maintain, and housing authorities have been losing federal funding for years. Berkeley's solution is to get out of public housing altogether and sell units to private developers, and that could affect access for some local residents. FSRN's Scott Pham has the story.
There's about a dozen townhouse-style units in the Ward Street Housing Project in South Berkeley. It's a small complex located in a fairly nice neighborhood. An elementary school is next door, and a higher-end grocery store is just a few blocks away. Longtime resident Keith Carlisle is showing me around.
Well, I'm disabled. I'm carrying my Segway, walking across some roughage here that is just very, very unsightly and very unkept.
Carlisle is taking me behind the housing project so I can see some of the wear and tear in the buildings.
They will allow the maintenance to be deferred to such an extent that raw sewage comes up through the floors of this apartment here, through the showers, and that this is an unsafe apartment for anyone to move into. So
nobody lives
no
here.
One lives there.
That's why it's boarded up.
Maintenance issues like bad plumbing and faulty roofs have been plaguing the Berkeley projects for years. The Berkeley Housing Authority, or BHA, can't even balance their operating budget each year. At this point, catching up with repairs is unlikely. The BHA owns only 75 units, and by their own estimate, the buildings need $4.5 million in repairs and improvements. With other costs, like financing and architectural fees factored in, renovations could cost $8 million. The BHA's solution to this problem is to simply get out of Public Housing Administration. They plan to sell all 75 units to one or more private developers. The BHA plans to temporarily relocate the tenants while the developer renovates the buildings. According to Carol Norris, chair of the BHA's board of directors, most residents will be able to come back. Only the developer will be the landlord, subsidized by the BHA.
For those people who move temporarily and come back to their units, they will be coming back to a unit that has a project-based Section 8 voucher attached to it. And that project-based voucher would provide the difference between the fair market rent on that unit and what that household can actually pay.
But some residents won't be coming back. All of the units are built for large families. And if a family has children who have moved out, the parents won't be eligible for the large units they currently occupy. Anyone who won't or can't return will be given what's called a Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher. The voucher is different than the project-based Section 8 program that Norris talked about. Under that program, tenants pay up to 30% of their income toward rent, and the BHA takes up the rest. But a Section 8 voucher isn't attached to an apartment or a house. Tenants have to find a landlord that opts into the program. And someone with a voucher may end up paying a lot more than the 30% max the other programs have. Here's John Carella, a staff attorney with Bay Area Legal Aid, a firm that offers free legal services to residents of public and subsidized housing.
There are limits to what the housing authority will pay for rent in a unit. There are payment standards. For example, the payment standard for a one-bedroom apartment in Berkeley is $1,278. If a unit costs that much or less, the tenant will generally pay 30% of their income, and the government will pay the rest of it. But if a unit costs more than that, if it costs $1,300 or $1,400 and it's a one-bedroom, the government will only pay enough to get it up to $1,278. The rest of that money becomes the responsibility of the tenant.
In low-income families, that extra $100 or $200 a month is significant. Over time, residents can get pushed out of certain neighborhoods because they're too expensive or nobody will accept their vouchers, or both. BHA Chair Carol Norris says she realizes that relocation can create hardship.
You know, there's an argument about not displacing people, but there's also an argument that suggests that if we're able to help those people move to another situation and make that unit available to a low-income household, especially a large family household, that we would be doing what the program was originally meant to do.
Norris says that selling the buildings and displacing some of the residents might be the only way to save the housing itself. Like all housing authorities, the BHA is empowered by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. HUD funds the local housing authorities, while Congress funds HUD. HUD was underfunded throughout the Bush years, and the deficit was spread around housing authorities all over the country. Catherine Bishop is with the National Housing Law Project. She says that with Section 8,
if you reduce the amount of money, you are actually taking units offline.
The human cost of cuts to Section 8 was more visible than those to public housing because people with private landlords would lose their housing immediately. Unlike public housing budgets, funding for Section 8 has been more reliable. Section 8 could even be used to relieve pressure on deficit-ridden housing authorities nationwide, as seems to be the plan in Berkeley. The BHA expects HUD to approve their plan to sell the Berkeley projects by the end of June. Scott Pham, FSRN, Berkeley.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Today's headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.